my point. I don't know if I've communicated that to you. Now, you all know about the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, what's interesting about this, and again, I'm so sorry I didn't save it or at least print it, but somebody sent an email if CNN had reported the attack on Pearl Harbor. So it sort of reported, you know, it's written a satire, but it basically, you know, kept underlining the fact that it was a military target. It was not American soil. It was an American colony, an American military colonial outpost. It sort of reported in the language that would be seen today, which would throw all kinds of doubt on whatever legitimacy the United States had in the first place of even having a military base, a naval base in Hawaii. But you all know about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And what's interesting is so outraged was the American population, you know, for among other reasons, that this was a sneak attack. This was a surprise sneak attack. That the country mobilized. And I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but before Pearl Harbor, we had a military about the size of Holland's. We did not have much of a serious military in December of 1941. All right, we just did not invest a whole lot in military expenditures. But because of Pearl Harbor, the United States mobilized, got itself onto a war footing, and enters World War II. And in 3.5 years, essentially the war is over. All right, and so, I mean, from the American point of view, World War II was not nearly as devastating as it was, you know, say, in Europe where it was fought, or in Japan. All right, now, a couple other things to note, and here's where I would put the context of Truman's decision to drop the bomb. Franklin Roosevelt stipulated fairly early on that our goal, our national goal in this war, is unconditional surrender. And again, nowadays, you know, we live in a different world, so nobody talks anymore about such things as unconditional surrender. And, you know, in fact, we even don't declare war like we used to. In other words, you know, there would be a declaration of war, which would be essentially passed by Congress, and that's how you have war official, you know, now we have an official war economy and we're officially at war. That's the last time the United States declared war. All right. In other words, nations used to have formal declarations of war. We don't have that anymore. Nations used to fight war until the other side capitulated, until the other side surrendered. We stated as our goal unconditional surrender. And I've, again, heard lectures here by colleagues that this was sort of like such an unconscionable, a clumsy blunder on the part of Franklin Roosevelt, because he set the terms of what the American people would expect out of this war so ridiculously high that it almost prepared people for this, you know, genocidal fight to the finish with Japan. But the war, the goal was unconditional surrender. Now, this was Roosevelt's legacy. Among the other things that were Roosevelt's legacy is he received a letter from Albert Einstein informing him of the potential of splitting the atom, and that the Max Planck Institute in Germany was already doing experiments along these lines. This is sort of a taking an idea of theoretical physics and giving it wartime application, which means building bombs that are unimaginably bigger than any bombs ever built. All right, these are what were called at the time ultimate weapons. So that Roosevelt, taking seriously this letter from Albert Einstein, and by the way, Einstein later regretted that he sent this letter, that he did this, because it set certain things into the motion that put us into this atomic age. So Roosevelt launched this big research project. This is called the Manhattan Project, and put a whole lot of resources into building a bomb. In a sense, there was, as far as the United States was concerned, a race to build this ultimate weapon. And again, many people speculated, what if Germany had seriously followed through on its initial research to build a bomb? World War II might have ended quite differently if Germany had developed the bomb first. Now, just as a little aside, you know, on my commute, I oftentimes listen to, you know, books on tape or books on CD. So this is all like last year's or 2 years ago fair. I've sort of been through most of the things that I want to listen to. But two books that are interesting that you could listen to on CD or cassette. One of them is called The Matrokhin Archives. He was like the head librarian of the KGB, and he got fed up with all their shenanigans, so he started taking notes on all of the files, and then he wanted to defect to America, walked into an American embassy, and you know they just threw him out. They didn't want to hear this. They didn't take him seriously. Walked into the British embassy and basically unloaded the largest treasure trove of classified, you know, secret intelligence ever. So we have it in the library. It's a really interesting book to read or interesting book to listen to. But among the interesting things there is Stalin, even though he's allied with the United States and Britain, spent far more resources spying on the United States and Britain during World War II than he did on Germany. And the Manhattan Project was completely compromised by Stalin's agents. Now, they knew everything that was going on, all the plans of building the bomb. They just have the whole thing as if it was all done right in front of the Soviet, you know, intelligence, which is an interesting thing to note. The other thing that's interesting is the book The Rape of Nanking is also in the library, and it's there in books on tape, and it's very interesting to listen to. It's not a pleasant story, but it'll kind of remind you of just the barbarity of what was going on during this time. But anyhow, so Franklin Roosevelt initiated this Manhattan Project, and then he dies. Harry Truman becomes president because Franklin Roosevelt dies in office. As Truman says, it's as if the earth, stars, and sun all fell on him. And where the war is coming is winding down, Truman inherits these three bombs. All right, Germany has surrendered. And so now the United States is going to have to focus all of its energies on fighting Japan. And as many would look at it, you know, war, you know, victory, not that it's inevitable, but, you know, the end is in sight. All right, with Germany out of the picture and America still in good fighting shape, you know, America's really just getting more and more mobilized. The United States has to prepare to fight Japan. Now, among the other things that happens, and this is also very important to understand in the context of the times, the Soviet Union, which was really beaten up badly in the war. I mean, they're victorious now. They have invaded Berlin. But, you know, the Russians lost 20 million people in World War I. I mean, they lost more people than anyone else did. Nonetheless, the Russians, the Soviets, declare war on Japan at the very last days of the war, I mean, toward the end, and begin to invade the northern islands of Japan. So the Kuril Islands, they still occupy, by the way. In other words, they occupy this in 1945. This is occupied territory of today that nobody talks about. And among the interesting things that was going on is they were going from these northern islands of Japan, and you see here you see them in brown on this map, whereas Japan's in green, the Soviet Union's in brown, and they were basically going to go all the way down, and they were getting into the war. The United States does not want them to join up in the war. They didn't care what the United States wanted. They're going in for their big land grab as well. Okay, so the Soviets are now into the war, and into the war for their own purposes. Japan recognizes that it's losing the war, so it sends out feelers for conditional terms of surrender in order to end the war. So scholars nowadays can point to, you see, there was some diplomatic activity going on between Japanese diplomats interested in coming to some kind of surrender terms. Not unconditional surrender, mind you, but some kind of agreement to stop the war, you know, because they knew what was going to, you know, they knew they were outnumbered. They could no longer hold out indefinitely against the United States. So the United States basically has a few options. One of them is to blockade Japan. Another one is to engage in a conventional bombing campaign of Japan. And again, this is something that we start to do. But the gnawing fact of the matter is, ultimately, the United States is going to have to invade Japan. And the thing about Japan is they fought to the last man. All right, in other words, they were not very much interested in surrender. In terms of the Japanese military, very good military, by the way, they fought to the last man. They considered surrender to be dishonorable. So generally, they didn't surrender. And just as a little short aside, at some point I'll get this computer to go on. I'll show you a picture of my mother's mother's family, the Kuznets family. So an interesting family, but one of the brothers, this is my mother's Uncle Benny, he fought in the Pacific in World War II, and he went from battle to battle to battle in the Pacific. And his mantra when he came back is they fought to the last man. He was the life of the party before the war. He came back a very, you know, different person. And everyone else, his other siblings, they all lived to be 100. You know, my grandmother, his sister, died at age 100 and a half. The youngest of the family, he might have been younger than she was, but the youngest surviving one, she just died in Montreal at age 103, Aunt Leah. Uncle Harry, my grandmother's older brother, he died at 106 2 years ago. 106. He's a Canadian veteran of World War I. You know, went to France in World War I. I'm just saying there's some longevity genes in this family. Uncle Benny died at age 51 of leukemia. You know, in other words, the war just, you know, he was not the same person. But, you know, as he put it, you know, they fought to the last man. Another one of my uncles, this is Uncle Sid Siegel, he fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He was there for the occupation of Germany. And when the bombs were dropped and the war ended, he was one happy man. Okay, why? Because after fighting, you know, bloody fights in Europe, he knew he was supposed to be shipped off to fight in Japan and be part of the invasion of Japan. And the invasion of Japan was not going to be any kind of picnic because of the tenacity with which they fought. There's the movie out now, Flags of Our Fathers, so you maybe now you're a little more familiar with the Battle of Iwo Jima, which was one of the costliest battles of the war. But the thing that's significant about Iwo Jima, even though it's far away from the Japanese mainland, from the Japanese, you know, Honshu and the main Japanese islands, Iwo Jima's right here. Japan's way up here. This little island, which was Japanese territory, they defended that territory essentially to the last man, which is why it was such a costly battle. So the idea that Japan was on the verge of surrender, that Japan would have surrendered, that a blockade would have worked, that conventional bombing would have done the same thing, I am not so sure. I look upon that as sort of applying, you know, modern day thinking and logic to a very different mentality and assuming that reason functions the same for everybody everywhere, and, you know, I wouldn't agree with that. So basically, Harry Truman had the following decision to make. We had built three bombs. So one was dropped as an experiment in Alamogordo, New Mexico, and boy, were they impressed. Now, they didn't know what it would be. I mean, it's all theoretical. Yeah. You know, they were worried that they'd have an uncontrolled nuclear chain reaction. I mean, there was all kinds of things. They didn't know about radiation. They didn't know about that. So the first bomb was dropped in New Mexico, and they realized, oh boy, this really works. So August 6th, they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima without any kind of serious warning. I mean, there was a little bit of saber rattling and all that, but no one took it seriously. In a flash, 66,000 people were killed, and another 69,000 people were injured by this bomb. All right, and it's a pretty grisly kind of destruction in this bomb. When you see that mushroom cloud, if you think what's in that smoke, it's basically tens of thousands of people and things reduced to smoke, you know, vaporized. And again, the photos, the, you know, video, movie images were suppressed. We didn't see that in America for, you know, and I don't know that you've ever seen that. In other words, this was not something that the American people saw much of. But you would see images of people just sort of incinerated. They just reduced, just vaporized, you know, all in a flash. And 3 days later, so the United States demands its unconditional surrender. The Japanese, they're not so ready to surrender. They're trying to figure out what happened. 3 days later, the United States drops a bomb on Nagasaki. 39,000 people killed, 25,000 people injured. Now, we were all out of bombs. They didn't know that. It would take at least 6 months to make another batch. But the Japanese recognized, and what did the United States say it's going to do? We're going to pick off your cities one by one until we get our unconditional surrender. They surrendered. All right, and the war ended. Now, if you look at it from the Habibi point of view, the moral justification is, 66,000 people killed in Hiroshima, 39,000 people killed in Nagasaki, is a lot less than would have been killed had the United States done this conventionally or had the United States invaded Japan. Truman himself was told there will be at least 1 million American casualties if we invade Japan. In other words, we lost about 500,000, I think 550,000 men or troops in World War II. You could probably double that if we would have invaded Japan. And many more Japanese would have been killed had we gone to, the conventional route of an invasion and all that. The fact that it ended the war, in many ways, sad and horrible and horrific as it was, it was a blessing compared to the alternatives. All right, that's, again, my opinion, although I think it's more than an opinion. Now, I had a history teacher, a history professor at UCLA. He's probably not alive anymore, an older guy named Albert Hoxie. And he gave a lecture on World War II, 50-minute lecture on World War II. But he made the point, and again, he talked about the most horrific aspects of the war and talked about the atomic bombs on Japan. But what he said was really interesting and sort of stuck with me. He said, "I'm glad they dropped the bombs on Japan." And again, I'm thinking, why? Are you glad? Please explain. And he explained that the bombs we had in 1945, these were these teeny-weeny 20 tons of TNT atomic bombs. If we wouldn't have dropped it on Japan, we would have probably dropped it on Korea to end the Korean War. And by then, we had the hydrogen bomb, which was probably like 100 times more powerful. It was a good thing that we dropped the bombs then, because so shocked and horrified was the world that these bombs have not been used since. Had we not used them then, we might have used them later, and later the bombs get deadlier and more destructive. Now, there's lots more to say on this, but we're running out of time, so I will dismiss you, and hopefully I'll get that in on the next lecture. Yes, I did. Stanley Kubrick, great movie. I've showed that to a class. Who teaches politics and film?
Dr. Roller.
Oh, Lloyd, yeah.
Yeah, great.
That's a good movie, yeah. The president of the United States' name is Merkin Muffley. Do you know what Merkin means?
It means the vaginal area of the female.
No, it actually is, it's the hair.
The hair, the pubic hair.
And it's also a wig.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's Borat makes mention. He doesn't use that term, but the hair there. But so anyhow, I guess that's
right,
a commodity.
He was going to trade it for something,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh well, yes, Kristen. Hello.
I wanted to remind you. I had emailed you over the summer.
Yes.
How I would not be able to attend classes before Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay.
And so. Remind you, and I want to, is there something I can do to make up?
What is the class just before Thanksgiving? Do you know the topic?
Affirmative action.
Okay, in all likelihood, for sure, not in likelihood, I will email you very extensive notes on affirmative action. And in addition to that, I hope to record it.
Okay.
And so all you got to do is borrow the CD and download it on your computer, so whatever you miss, you'll be able to get. So
okay.
Go have a wonderful time back in Long Island. Is it Long Island?
Mm-hmm.
It's
upstate.
Upstate. Where in upstate?
Outside Albany. Saratoga.
Saratoga. Burnt Hills. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't worry about that. You'll be fine.
It's just because the price difference between
you'll be. No. As far as I'm concerned, if you're making the flight and you can get like an extra 4 or 5 days at home, then go home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
eat your
you.
Thanksgiving Thank dinner
much.
Where you belong.
Thank you.
Okay.
I emailed you the extra credit.
Samantha?
Yeah, did you get it?
Yeah, I got it. Yes, it was a pain, but I got it.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. No, it's because I read them all and graded them all, and then I discovered yours, and then there was yours, and I don't know which section is she in, and all. Don't worry about it. No, everyone got the same 5 points, whether they deserved it or not.
Sorry.
Robin Grice.
Thank you.
So you're aware of Roland Grice. Did you get your paper, Samantha? Well, come here. Well, that's probably because I had you pegged for 002.
Oh.
And so you're not in 002?
No.
Hang on, so I got you in 001. Yeah, Samantha Brown, there you are. See, yours even got filed way differently. That's the problem. Troublemaker. Bye, I'm just teasing you, you know. I hope she knows that. How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm worn out, plum tuckered out.
I'm going to have to leave class about 7. I'm going to take a friend to work.
What a lame excuse.
Oh, I know. That was pretty good.
Your friend is helpless?
My friend doesn't have a car.
How are you?
This gentleman right here, this lady, I was hoping
I could get here earlier so I could audit this class, but I've kind of been eavesdropping. Oh. I've been very informed. Thank you very much.
Oh, where,
so
where did you come in?
I'm sitting out here. Very good.
Now, you're too young to be a veteran of World War II, correct?
Correct.
But you were old enough to, you know, you were...
I'm a very good historian, though.
Yeah. So I don't know if you see it my way, but among my colleagues, this is often cited as an example of, you know, just like the evil of that is the United States.
The evil of the United States.
Yeah.
I see it as the greatness of the United States.
Yeah, well, it ended the war.
Yeah, exactly.
It ended the war.
I think it's very utilitarian.
It saved a lot of Japanese lives as well as a whole lot of...
It's like Sherman. It's like Sherman. Yeah.
With Sherman's March?
Yeah, I mean, he saved thousands of Confederate and Union troops by his brilliant march to Atlanta. He basically used a scorched earth policy so the South Sioux peace. You know.
Well, I guess I never thought of it in those terms, but I don't know. That's not as fresh in my mind. You know,
yeah.
I don't know if you heard the part, you know, but I grew up, World War II was, you know, was very fresh in people's minds.
Yeah, my father would be best.
Yeah.
Anyway,
no problem.
Sometime when you got a chance, I wanted to.
Was it you who sent me the New York Times?
No, but what I want to do is
take
a look at that. Uh-huh. Okay, that's going to give an objectivist viewpoint on.
So it's new. They're only on volume one, I see.
Right. Well, I've got volume 1, 2, and 3. But if you look at that, and see what you think. I'm giving it to you. If you want it, you can accept it. If not, you can throw it in the trash.
No, I wouldn't throw it in the trash, but I'll keep it in my office. So if you want it back, just come in.
If you have a chance to look at it.
Yeah, the last one looks interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That looks interesting.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people don't want to see, you know, it's just too difficult for them to sort of take it in.
Yeah. But it's really got a good take on art, on impressionism.
Oh, wow.
I just went to that.
I spent a lot of time. I've seen both. I think this is in France.
Yeah.
But this one was in the Metropolitan Museum of Art for many years.
Yeah.
I've looked at this one a lot.
Yeah. But I was in Raleigh a couple weeks ago and saw the Claude Monet exhibit up there.
Uh-huh.
But that gives a good take on that, too. Anyway, I've got to go on. I'll hold you up.
What did Ayn Rand think of impressionism?
She thinks it's bad philosophy in the sense that
David Hume.
Well, it's just kind of out of focus. You know?
It's out of focus, but it's beautiful.
Well,
you know,
what is art? What is art? You know, and what's the
Well, thank you. Is this something you need? This?
Well, no, that is actually some a form that you
that
can get in the library. The library wouldn't maybe put it in.
The library has already cut out all these journals.
Huh? I'd pay for it if you could get it in there.
Hell, I will mention to Sherman,
okay.
You know, the head of the library, if someone's going to pay for it, that might make it all okay for
Well,
him.
He told me, he said, well, once you pay for it, then they got to keep paying for it. I've already
yeah.
asked him about it, but since the professor would do it, they might have more clout, you know.
I'll mention it to him. Okay, so does this have a way to get in touch with you? Maybe
let me
write a phone number or something.
Let me put a card in there.
Yeah, a card in there. So how the rest of the course has been going well, I
think. Great, great. I'm really enjoying it. And as a matter of fact, what I want, would like to do is next year.
Carolina Beach.
Yeah. Can you read that? The next year is, I've been looking at your schedule for next year. I don't know if I can either audit or either take one of your
political conflict. Level. Yeah, but you're welcome to come to that. That'll be an interesting class.
But my long-term objective is to get a degree in philosophy.
Oh, well, if you're in Carolina Beach, then we're the only game in town. All right, good talking to you, Fred. Hello, everybody. I better run off for a minute just to maintain my sanity here.
Not last time. Last week, there weren't that many people. But we don't have class on Thursday, though.
Oh, we don't have class on Thursday.
Yep. Nice. I have a test the next day. Do you know when Thanksgiving break is?
Yeah, I thought
so. Teach them is it Thursday and Friday?
Wait, no.
Is it? When's Thanksgiving?
I think. Do you know when Thanksgiving break is?
21st. Well, that's Tuesday. It's after
3 o'clock.
Are you?
So like at night on Tuesday.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Okay. Okay. No, you can do it. I don't know if you want it, though.
Okay, hello everybody. Is it time to start? Yes, it is time to start. Let's get started. I must drink some water here. All right, a few announcements and then it's off to the races. So this side of the room is here. Where's your side of the room, Grant?
I don't know. Probably not coming because of the hurricane. So.
Did you not bathe or eat lots of garlic or something?
Now,
Kayla called, and she's in Jacksonville, and I told her, I said, don't come. She only has this class. I said, don't come. I'll record it. You know, don't drive in this weather. But the rest of the class is starting to, you want to come join us? Does you want to come and?
I'm fine.
Okay. So if you're happy, that's fine.
I'm trying to migrate you.
What did you say?
Trying to migrate you,
yeah. All right, today is the 7th. All right, here's the story, folks. Several things to announce, and then we'll go from there. Okay, number one. What would the number one thing be? Let's return papers. By the way, all these people weren't in the first class. It's a bad day for people showing up, I think. Let's try right here. Put that there. All right, so... Ricarda ist hier. Yeah. Moment, ich bringe diese Papier. Alright, Brandon is not here. I saw her, there she is, Kelly Foster. You have to get up, I'm right here for you. Alright, Josh Williams, right in front. Right back to Brad Hill. Davan, I'm gonna say. Will Edwards. There he is. Where is Lori Harrison?
Oh yeah.
Carolyn Whitfield. Robin Grice. And Kayla's not here. So we're missing Brandon, Kayla, and Lori Harrison. That's three. The other class, we're missing like 12 of them. All right. If you have questions on what I marked, maybe just ask me at the end of class. I mean, here, AWK means awkward. Let's see. UL means underlined or italicized, like names of journals or books are underlined or italicized. And the names of articles are in quotes. Trying to see if I have any. All right, anyone have any questions off the bat? Everyone who did it got 5 points, which is good to have. All right, put these here. And put these here for next time. Okay, that's one announcement. Okay, announcement number two. Next Thursday, we will not meet, okay? So this is what this means is on the schedule we have, I think, virtue ethics and feminist ethics all thrown into one class. You're not responsible for that reading. It's just scratched from the program. I kind of suspected it would be, only because as I'm teaching this course, I'm weeding out certain things that didn't seem to be worth a whole lot of class time. So, you know, I can sum those up for you rather quickly.
I'm sorry, I couldn't find a parking spot.
You couldn't find a parking spot?
No, I had to park illegally.
You parked illegally?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I hope you don't get a ticket also. So in other words, parking is hard to come by right now, I guess because it's raining, but I'm thinking all these people aren't here, although now the class seems to be filling up, except for this side of the room, of course. But anyhow, so next Thursday, which means 2 days from now, I will be on campus, but at 6:30 I have to introduce these films at the Kukaloras Film Festival, so I'll be there, which means you're free as birds to do your thing. So just, you know, no need for you to come next Thursday. This coming Thursday, the 9th of November. Okay?
So not next Thursday.
November 9th, meaning 2 days from now. All right? And only that particular Thursday. As far as I know, after that, you know, all systems are go. And there was, I don't know if you recall, but at the beginning of the semester, I hadn't ironed out the dates, and now it looks like it's being postponed. So the following semester, I was invited and sort of still am to go to Washington State University to give some talks, but it's not happening this semester, but as I had anticipated it would, there's a little bit of flexibility in the schedule that I put in there, and the first thing to go, by coincidence, is what was scheduled for next Thursday, meaning this coming Thursday. All right? All right, so everyone be clear, no class this coming Thursday. All right. A couple other announcements, and then let's get off to the races. The other announcements are that, unfortunately I don't read my New York Times right on time, so I didn't notice it, but this is in last Wednesday's New York Times, November 1st, so I wished I would have mentioned it November 2nd, but I hadn't seen it. It's on page 3 of the main section, Section 8. China moves to lessen the broad use of death sentences, acts to centralize a review process. So the interesting thing here is, you know, China, they're really into the death penalty in China. They apply it very liberally, as they say, meaning that, you know, people for all kinds of offenses get executed there. And I think it's, you know, I read this, I'm trying to remember the actual number they gave, but it's, basically, you know, they're executing close to 2,000 people a year. All right, so, you know, they put the state of Texas to shame as far as, you know, vigorous application of the death penalty. So they're starting to react to world pressure, and they're going to try and be a little bit more systematic about how they apply it. So that's just something interesting to note. And the other interesting thing to note, which would be worth a trip to the library or on the internet, you might be able to get it, in last week's science news. Every Tuesday, the New York Times has a science news section, and it's really wonderful, especially for people like me, who, you know, I'm not a scientist. They basically put together in that science news section of the paper sort of the latest research findings and interesting things and practical, applicable things going on with science and health. And so it's a good place to pick up on a lot of the latest research, you know, which may become outdated, but for the time being, coffee is healthy for you, so I'm going to go with it. You know, it could be 10 years from now they'll decide it's not healthy, and then 20 years from now they'll decide it's healthy again. But the point is, it's a good place to get sort of interesting news from the scientific world. And on the front page of the Science Times of last week, and I have it here with me on campus, I didn't somehow get it to class with me. There's an article on ethical sense as not being a social construct, but being something that we're genetically hardwired, that our brains are hardwired with a sense of right and wrong that is somehow universal. All right, so it wasn't a very convincing article. It's a product of what's called evolutionary psychology or evolutionary biology, also known as sociobiology. I've mentioned this in class before, but and again, I could say, do any of you know what I mean? And you'll say yes, but then some of you won't. A very interesting field in the scientific world is this evolutionary psychology. It's the brainchild of Edward O. Wilson, who will be at UNCW this coming March. Go hear him. All right, he's a real great pioneer of science of the 20th century. He wrote a book which came out around 1977-78 called Sociobiology, A New Synthesis, and he basically founded a whole new scientific discipline. And what they do is they basically glean whatever they can from, you know, all the different areas of science, including social science, meaning they'll take what we know from genetics, from medicine, from physiology, from chemistry, from biochemistry, from archaeology, from sociology, from criminal justice, and glean it together and assume that the same principles that apply to other social creatures. E.O. Wilson, his specialty is ants, but he's also a specialist in social insects like wasps, bees, termites, hornets, and you know, social animals like, you know, deer or cattle, horses, and basically argue that the same forces that determine their behavior drive human behavior, which means, as I've told you so bluntly, that from a biological point of view, you are really simply a life support system for sperm or eggs. I've told you this, yes? Never told you that? I never said that to the class?
I think so.
Well, the harsh scientific reality is that, you know, your hopes, your dreams, your talents, all of this, all that really it's about is mate selection and reproduction. Because from a biological point of view, that's ultimately what matters. You know, not how much money you make, not how famous you are, and how much money you make or how famous you are matters in the sense that it might be a positive thing in terms of finding partners and reproducing. But the most important thing you do from the biological point of view is project your genes for the next generation by creating children who are 50% of your genes. That's what really matters. That's what it's all about. And say, if you decide you would rather have a career, or you'd rather, I don't know, have more freedom and money to spend on yourself, then in a sense, you're relegating yourself to genetic oblivion, because you're the end of the line. And all of us are the product of an unbroken chain that extends back, you know, tens of thousands, millions of years. So to not reproduce basically puts you at the end of the line. So just something to keep in mind. All right, so anyhow, this evolutionary psychology, they try and understand everything in terms of what I just said, all right, and make it fit. So they're trying to understand the ethical sense, and they come up with studies. I didn't find it very convincing, so I'm not making it mandatory that you read it, but it's worth taking a look at. So it's in last Tuesday's New York Times, the Science News, which is it's its own section of the Times. It's on the front page of that section. So try and go find it if you can. And I'll probably, hopefully, remember to bring it with me next week. I have it in my office somewhere. I brought it to school with me today. Okay, any questions before I get started? No? Ready to go? Okay, so now I'm going to try recording this again. Take a big swig of water and let's get going. Okay. Let's see. First, I turn this on. Yes. And then I turn this on.